Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. But in this case, the guest is me. So I had the chance to join Matt and Ben on The Sci-Fi Christian, which is their podcast. Matt and Ben have both been guests on my podcast, and they were kind enough to let me join them for a discussion of The Once and Future King. Now, the first section of The Once and Future King is The Sword and the Stone, which is chronologically the oldest of the retro Hugo winners. So rather than doing a separate episode for this podcast, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop in that discussion that I had with Matt and Ben. Just be aware that it talks about the entire collection, The Once and Future King, not just The Sword and the Stone. So slightly different from a typical episode, but still, I thought it was an enjoyable conversation. So I hope you enjoy that. I also needed a month off because I had some other reading that I needed to get done, some projects that I was working on, and a job change. So that is my excuse for not doing an original episode this month, because this is one that I tweeted it out that I had been on the show. So if you've heard it before, I apologize. You can skip on down to the next episode, and I will be back with a new episode in June. So I'll send you over to that discussion with past Matt, Ben, and Seth. It was funny because we actually kind of talked about calling the episode The Once and Future Podcast because it was posted in their feed, and now it's finally getting posted in mine. So without further ado, here's that discussion.
Episode 681, King Arthur's Crossover Connection, The Once and Future Podcast. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I'm Ben DiBono.
And today, we are joined by our friend, all the way from two other podcasts.
Oh, no, hang on.
What?
We have someone who's on the line, and I'd just like to say, who goes there?
Oh. I like it.
Because it's Seth, and he hosts a show called Hugo Is There.
Yeah, that's right.
It's about the
very nice
Hugo Awards.
He also hosts the show Take Me to Your Reader, two podcasts that we've both been on.
Yeah,
but never together.
Yeah,
right?
I figure it's about time you guys paid me back.
Right,
I've had you both on both podcasts.
Well, you've been on ours. We stole your audio and put it out. And
right, so
that
you
is true.
Really you've been on our rebranded show multiple times.
Yeah, multiple times. Actually, more than most people.
Yeah, we don't like guests. So
well,
this
Ben
is,
doesn't like guests.
Well, yeah, but we don't like collectively. We don't like guests.
That's not true.
No, I'm talking about us as a unit.
Well,
and you can have your own opinion outside of the unit, but the unit doesn't like guests, and so it's a pretty big honor when you get on more than once.
So here we are.
I was going to say that. I do feel tremendously honored. So thank you.
That's great.
Seth, we've had these plans for quite a while because you heard me mention it, I think, way back at the beginning of the year that I'm going to be reading The Once and Future King by T.H. White. Mm-hmm. And you messaged me because we have a close internet relationship. That sounds weird. I just mean that as our podcast friends go.
I don't want to know.
As our podcast friends go, I think you and I talk quite often.
Yeah, I think so.
And so we've had these plans for months. Here we are. I finally finished this book last week. When did you finish it?
Oh, it's been a couple of weeks now, to the point that it's kind of faded. And I'm counting on you guys to drive the conversation.
Well, so I finished it a couple months ago.
Yep.
So I guess it's all nice. In Matt's court.
I've got this. I just finished it not even 1 week ago.
Now you both were Once and Future King virgins. Is that correct?
Yes, my first time.
That is correct.
Oh, this was my second time.
All right. Now, have you read, and you have read, La Morte d'Arthur by Mallory?
Yeah, and I'm rereading it very slowly right now.
Okay. And I started reading Mallory first upon all of our listeners' recommendations. And I was about, not very far into it. When you said, don't do that.
Well, you can be more truthful. It was my recommendation, my insistence that you start with Mallory. And then I started rereading Once and Future King, and I decided that was terrible advice.
Because why?
Because I thought you would enjoy it more in this direction, that you would get more out of La Morte d'Arthur by reading T.H. White first and being familiar with the stories in a more accessible form and then going back to Mallory and reading them there.
Now, Seth, you tried to do the same thing, didn't you? Did you start with Mallory?
Oh, I considered it. I did actually look up Mallory and started kind of flipping through it, and it was not really to my taste, I have to admit. And so then I really liked Ben's advice that, okay, maybe reading it in the more accessible format mm-hmm. first will make it so that I can go back and then check out Mallory. But I didn't do that.
You know, and you can almost, not to skip to the end, but Mallory shows up as a character at the end of The Once and Future King.
I know, it's crazy.
So you can almost say that that's a sequel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's wild.
It is.
It's like Merlin living backwards, right?
Right.
Yeah, I was interested in how White did continually reference Mallory's work and then ended up putting Mallory in as a short-lived character. Well, it's more of a cameo is what I'm trying to say.
Right. So those will probably be the two. Well, obviously, Once a Future King will be the main one we talk about. But, well, what other Arthur exposure do we all have?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
So at some point, I think in college, I read the Stephen Lawhead Pendragon cycle.
Yeah.
So that's Taliesin, Merlin, Arthur, Pendragon, and Grail. Other than that, I don't think I ever saw the animated Sword in the Stone movie. I just recently watched Excalibur, which is considered a classic, but it's they don't make them like they used to, I guess. Something maybe lost in translation, I think, from the 80s till now.
Yeah, I watched Excalibur a number of years ago, and I feel like I want to revisit it now that I'm reading more Mallory and read T.H. White, because I had a very similar reaction where I did not care for it in the slightest when I saw it.
Yeah, to me, it was just like it wanted to be epic, and somehow the epicness of it just made it melodramatic to me.
Right. It's in that great epic gulf of emptiness between Lawrence of Arabia and The Lord of the Rings. There's like 30 years there where things didn't go quite so hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then other than that, my son and I watched Merlin that was on Netflix. I guess it was sci-fi originally, but that was kind of fun.
Yeah, I was thinking about watching
that. That's it.
I have not watched Merlin, but that's been on my radar to check out. Sword in the Stone, the Disney movie, that's the big one for me. I saw that as a kid and then recently watched it. Actually, let me think about this. I might have seen it twice in the last couple of years watching it with my kids. And I was shocked when I started reading Sword in the Stone how much Disney really adapted that first novel in this collection. So that was pretty good. Of course, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Right.
Little King Arthur action there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a lot.
What else?
I didn't mention that one because that one's so obvious, but also I forgot.
I have not, but in a long time, but growing up, I watched the Richard Gere movie, First Night, a couple of times, starring Sean Connery.
I have seen that, actually.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I believe DuckTales had some sort of King Arthur-themed episode.
So really, of all the great Arthurian literature written over the last 1,500 years, we're down to DuckTales.
Yeah, it's crazy. I've always been interested.
And Richard Gere.
I've always been interested in the story of King Arthur, and I love the round table concept, and Merlin's just a great character. But with that being said, this was really my first big exposure to the mythology. I learned a lot reading this book, reading this collection.
What did you like about the round table if you hadn't read any King Arthur? Just it's round?
I liked the idea. I knew kind of the thought behind it, that there's no one at the head of the table. They're all in this equally together.
That's true. So I've read not a lot of Arthurian mythos, but I've read Parsifal, which is a French poem. It's incomplete from the Middle Ages.
Also, that character has a very small role in Once and Future King.
He does, but it's because White more or less skips over the Grail quest.
Yeah, so he's entirely bigger in Mallory.
Yeah,
very much so. Mallory spends a long time on the Grail quest. I think White,
Parsifal specifically.
Yeah, Parsifal's a huge character as part of the Grail mythos. But I think White even mentions when he skips over the Grail, I'm skipping over this because Mallory did it the best.
Yeah.
Which you could have said that about the whole Arthurian legend to begin with. So I think it's just laziness.
The truth is, he's like, I'm so close to the end, but I have the whole Holy Grail part. Wait a second. If you want to read that, check out Mallory. Now let's move on.
Now, I've also read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight a number of times.
What's the Green Knight?
Well, you have to read it.
Okay.
Read and find out. And then I've seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which also has the Holy Grail, but perhaps unrelated.
I've seen that one. The best of all the Indiana Jones movies,
okay,
in my opinion. What about Tolkien? Did you ever read The Fall of Arthur?
Yes, I have.
For it or against it?
For it, of course.
All right.
Yeah. So I guess we're not Arthur experts here.
No, I learned a ton.
No, not really. Hey, did either of you guys see the Clive Owen King Arthur movie? I just remembered I saw that one.
No, and with Keira Knightley?
Actually, I did, Seth. I saw that in the theater, but never again.
And then there was another one a year ago or so with a Guy Ritchie.
I also didn't see that one.
Right.
And he was going to do like 10 no. King Arthur movies, but then it didn't make any money because it sucked.
No. So it's interesting, though, talking about that more recent movie, I was reading an article that was talking about how what a flop it was. And the article just kind of said, maybe King Arthur just isn't relevant anymore. And it's interesting thinking about that and then thinking about the way the Once in the Future King works and comments on the time in which T.H. White was writing it.
Yeah, that is an interesting point we'll get to, I think, because there's something really interesting in terms of that conversation, because I think that part of what T.H. White is doing with the entire novel or cycle of novels, however you want to think about it, is he's trying to ask that question of what does King Arthur mean in light of World War I and World War II and the changes of the 20th century, and especially if we consider Arthur as being an archetypal figure of what it means to be British and of the British spirit. It would be incredibly sad if that's the case, that it doesn't have relevance anymore, I think, because it would mean that something fundamental to what it means to be British isn't relevant anymore. And I think that would be very tragic on a major level, but it's certainly a possibility. I mean, you think of how radically culture has changed over the 20th century. And I think that even White is struggling with that a little bit, and you know, we'll get into more of the details in a bit, but there are points where I think, especially in the final book, the Book of Merlin, where he feels like he's trying to make Arthur fit a mold that maybe he doesn't naturally occupy.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think he's trying to take White's coming at things, and this is part of why Book of Merlin wasn't published with Once and Future King originally, because it was so very controversial. It's highly pacifistic, and that was a tough sell in post-World War II Great Britain try and present that point of view. And not to comment anything for or against or neutral on that point of view, but that's a difficult point of view to make the claim that White does in that last book, that this is the perspective that Arthur occupies or that Arthur points us in that direction. I'm not saying you can't, but it is a pretty radical departure from the traditional understanding of the Arthurian mythos.
I'd agree with that. I've been interested in, we talked a little bit about this on Facebook, the three of us, but I'm interested in this idea of how these individual books inside Once and Future King were released. So, you know, for Seth, for your podcast, Seth, Hugo's There. I think it's specifically The Sword and the Stone that won the Hugo. Is that right?
Yeah, it was awarded the Retro Hugo.
Okay. Yeah. So, but I mean, there is essentially five books inside this one book called Once and Future King. I was trying to argue with Ben on if I should get credit on Goodreads for five individual books. Or is this just one book? Ben, what side did you take?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a terribly interesting discussion for discussing actual novel.
It sets up,
it's a bookkeeping question.
No, it sets up my next part.
Okay, fine. It's one book.
Okay. Seth?
Oh, boy. I mean, thinking about the history of it, of course, The Sword and the Stone was originally published as a standalone book. So I think if you were going to count it as multiple books, you could maybe count two, where The Sword and the Stone, the original version, if you could find it, would count as one, and then the rest would count as one book as well.
See, early on,
I don't have a lot of conviction about that.
Yeah, early on, I felt pretty strongly.
Well, I do, and I'm going to tell you why. Because we take our books read very seriously in terms of counts here at the Sci-Fi Christian. And somebody is trying to cheat. And that's all there is to it. If we didn't take it that seriously, he wouldn't think twice about just recording it as one book.
That's totally true.
And he's trying to game the system. I listened to Once and Future King, and you can go on to my Goodreads right now, and you'll see one book counted for it.
Now, here,
nonsense.
Early on, I thought this is clearly five books. But then when I finished, so I listened to the audiobook, but I also own Once and Future King in real book version. And I told you guys this, my book version only has four of the five books, and then the fifth one was still on the audio. So I was trying to figure out what's the deal here. The fifth one was only ever released in a version of the composite Once and Future King, but you had Once and Future King, Sword and the Stone came out individually. The Witch in the Wood came out as its own book, but then when they made the composite version, They called it the Queen of Air and Darkness and revised it quite a bit.
Right.
Ill Made Night came out individually, but Candle in the Wind, the fourth part, only came out as part of the composite. So in the end, after I'd finished the whole experience and I felt how the momentum was building from section to section or book to book, you could say, I think I do agree that Once a Future King is one book and not five, but it's a, I think there's an argument to be made both ways, but I think on when it's all said and done, I'm going to log it as one book on Goodreads. And my numbers are going to drop drastically.
It's called integrity.
I might have to do that too, because I have to admit, Matt, I was swept away in your wish to add books, because I started doing that as well.
Yeah. So because Queen of Air and Darkness and Candle in the Wind and Book of Merlin never really existed as they now exist, I don't think I can say that this is five books.
Well, I'm proud of you, Matt. Thank you. Because I know there's a lot of temptation there.
I track my books separately off of Goodreads as well. And on that database, I tracked The Sword in the Stone as a book. And then I tracked The Once and Future King as a book because I listened to the entire thing on audio, but I read The Sword in the Stone in print.
Oh, okay.
So,
Yeah, I think that it.
So that's how I squeezed an extra one out of it.
Because one of the things I've thought about doing is I thought about reading Sword in the Stone to my kids. But I don't necessarily want to read all the other parts to my kids because I get a little bit more grown up.
No,
I
mean, you don't.
Yeah, not horrifically so, but you know, I've got 10 and 8, so they're a little young for some of that material. Right. But I think they'd enjoy Sword in the Stone quite a bit. So I could see recording Sword of the Stone as a book read if I read it out loud to them. But I think Once and Future King is a novel. That's how it's typically thought of, as a singular novel. You know, and the other ones are maybe more novella length. Sword of the Stone is also quite a bit longer than any of the other parts. And so I think that lends to Seth's interpretation that if you want to take one as a standalone, that's the one to do. Whereas the others, especially once you get into Arthur's adulthood, they really do become pretty interdependent.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Yeah, they do. If you didn't know you were transitioning from one book to the other, I don't think you would assume that, right?
No, the biggest transition is from Sword of the Stone to the rest of it, because Sword in the Stone,
yes,
it really almost feels more, it's more playful. I mean, Merlin, you can make an argument that the Merlin of the Sword in the Stone is a very different character from the Merlin of the other books. You could make an argument that the Merlin of Book of Merlin is a third character altogether. But there's a huge difference in tone. The work matures a great deal, and I think it's commendable that it does, because it grows along with its main character, and I think that there's that's part of what the charm of the entire work is.
What about the transition to Ill Made Night, which I think is the best section of the whole book? That moves away from Arthur and really puts a spotlight on Lancelot.
Well, I think it's, you know, that's a valid part of the Arthur mythos, though.
I guess what I'm saying is, you said the biggest transition was from one to two. I don't know. I think two to three was a pretty big transition, too.
Yeah, but that's more, I guess the distinction I would take there is that the early transition is one of tone and style, not just of content.
Yeah.
It's a natural, if you read the Arthur mythos, like I mentioned the two older ones that I've read, Percival, that Arthur, I don't think, appears at all in that. He might be referenced, but he doesn't appear at all. And Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, he only appears as an ancillary character. And I think as you read Mallory, you'll find that this is the case quite a bit, that Arthur as the main character, largely, he'll pop up now and again, but it's really about his rise to power and his death are the two areas that occupy him the most, where he is the most front and center. But other than that, it's really about his realm, and it's about the different characters and knights in his realm.
What did you think then about the fact that Mallory's book is called The Death of Arthur, but then when we go to Once and Future King, the death section, pretty minimal?
Well, I mean, first of all, Mallory's book really isn't just about the death of Arthur, and I don't.
It's called La Morte d'Arthur.
Yeah, but he didn't come up with that title.
Okay,
it was added on later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
but you get what I'm saying, right? Like that's the title of Mallory, but then when you go to Once and Future King, I don't even know if there was an exact death scene.
No, there really isn't. And it's interesting because the end of Once and Future King, there is a more subtle or gradual transition in style as well, away from traditional narrative and more towards kind of this almost a pseudo history, a descriptive of what happens. We aren't really involved in the action so much. There are long sections, you know, where they're going back and forth and Lancelot's besieged in France and he has Guinevere and all of that, where we're not really following the story beat by beat in the same way that we have. We're more checking in and getting snapshots here and there. I think that White makes an intentional choice to leave Arthur where he leaves him as a figure who he leaves him in life and he leaves him at a crossroads, especially if you don't take the Book of Merlin, if you take the original stuff. And I think he leaves him at a point of ambiguity because there's a high degree of ambiguity in terms of how White understands the mythology. I guess I don't read too much into Malory's work being called the Mort d'Arthur and White not dwelling on that scene just because Malory's work really isn't the death of Arthur. That's just what the title that was applied to it is. There's almost none of it is about that.
It's interesting. Well, Seth, I know you had some kind of the more general questions that you like to ask during your podcast, so I want to make sure we get to those. Do you want to talk a little bit about those things?
Yeah, I mean, some of that stuff is just kind of the get to know my first time guest kind of thing. And since you guys have both been on, I don't think any of that necessarily applies. But if we wanted to circle back around to talking more about the Sword and the Stone, like Ben mentioned, it's a very different tone. It's a very different style of book, right? It's obviously targeted at a younger audience. And like Ben was saying, right, I might read The Sword and the Stone to my kids, but maybe not quite the rest of it yet, because I feel like the themes and everything that are in the rest of the books are much, much more adult than in The Sword and the Stone. Even though there's a lot of profound insights in The Sword and the Stone about politics and how government should work and the use of power, which is expanded on in The Once and Future King, it's told in more of a kid-friendly way, right? With him getting changed into animals. So how about we talk some about that part?
Yeah. Well, don't forget Robin Hood.
That's right. Robin Wood.
I think you mean Robin Wood.
Yeah, Robin Wood.
Yeah, that was kind of a wild one. Where
I was surprised.
You didn't see that coming.
I did not.
Now, I have not seen the movie in a long time. Does Robin Wood show up in the Sword and the Stone
Good
movie?
Good question. He does not. You're talking about the Disney movie.
Yes.
No, he's not in the Disney movie, but there is a lot of changing to animals.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a main theme. But I bet you that Disney doesn't, like, they don't understand any thematic value to any of it because they're just a garbage company that produces horrible things.
Wow. And you know, Seth, evil listeners may not know you hate Disney, whereas I love Disney.
Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, why do you love
Disney? You know, I was just thinking, actually, Disney's upcoming streaming service is going to have a live action Sword in the Stone movie.
Why would it be live action?
That's what they're doing.
They're remaking it?
They're remaking it live action.
Well, it's probably not going to be just on the streaming
service. It is. It's going to be one of their streaming service exclusive movies. Not in the theater, not on DVD, just streaming.
Okay.
Yeah,
Fine. I guess I'm not going to see that.
Seth, do you think you're going to buy Disney Play, the streaming service? I'm in. You like Star Wars? You like Pixar? You like Marvel? You like Disney? It's perfect.
I don't think I'm going to get it. No.
That's the right choice.
All right, anyway, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I like DC Comics too, and I'm not paying for their streaming service. Of course, yeah,
I hear you.
Most of the movies are terrible. So
yeah,
at least the recent ones. What did you guys think of the formula of The Sword and the Stone? Because to be honest, I found it to be a little bit of a slog just going, oh, okay, we're going to turn into another animal. That's what we're going to do here. And I wasn't a huge fan of it. Actually, of the book in general and of the fact that it just kind of kept repeating itself. It's something I have a real problem with in some books where I feel like we're not making any progress by going over the same thing. And I know it's not the same thing, but maybe, Ben, you can talk me out of this.
I don't know if I can talk you out of it because I don't know that I have a good argument against it. I'm kind of going to give a Matt Anderson answer of I liked it. which is not, wow. As everybody knows, it's not terribly convincing. I hear what you're saying, and honestly, it could have been even worse because two episodes were edited out of it and put into Book of Merlin
right
later. Mm-hmm. The ant and the goose were both part of that originally. I think that, yes, it's repetitive, but it's also, there's a gradual cycle of growth, and mm-hmm. I think it's also, of all the stuff that he takes from Malory, the Sword in the Stone section of Mallory is incredibly brief. So I like that it puts Merlin front and center as a mentor to Arthur. I like the way that we see Arthur develop in that section. And I feel it feels earned then by the time we get to the point where he becomes king. I think it's White's attempt to take Arthur from being more of an archetypal figure, which he certainly is within the mythology, and turn him into a more full-fledged character within the work. He's trying to get behind the man a little bit and see, he's making his case for what are the values that drove Arthur and where did those come from.
You know, I'll actually take Seth's side a little bit in this because it took me a while to get into this book, Sword in the Stone I'm talking about. Yeah, I did feel like it dragged, and even when it got to Robin Wood, I was like, oh, that's interesting. But then it was, I didn't think the story was that compelling, but by the end of it, I really liked it. And then it, what it set up in the next couple books in the total collection, I loved. So as a whole, 5 stars for Once and Future King. But if I was going to grade any of them lower than 5, it would be this first one, and maybe Book of Merlin for being a disappointment.
Yeah, I think Book of Merlin is by far the weakest.
Yeah, so maybe
of the 5.
Yeah, so I think here's how I'd rank them: Ill Made Knight, Candle, and let me think about this. It's a tough one between 2 and 4, but then for sure, Sword in the Stone, second to last, Book of Merlin, last.
See, I think I'd actually, I think Sword in the Stone is probably a lot higher for me because I do like it. And I think that Sword in the Stone is what builds the foundation for all of those others to stand on. And that, especially when White shifts to the more, to the less descriptive, traditionally narrative style into something where it's more, we're just, jumping from episode to episode like we are in Candle in the Wind. And the reason why that can work without feeling like we're derailing the narrative is because we know who these characters are and we can understand who Arthur became and so, and how he became that. And so Sword in the Stone, is that. And I admire, I like the take on Merlin a lot in there. I like that, I like the different perspective. I think that it works in a lot of different ways, not only just as a setup, but as we've already talked about quite a bit, it works as its own novel in a way that the others don't. I think it takes a talent to have that type of a shift in tone and style throughout a single work. And so I admire the craftsmanship that White portrays there. I mean, I think that, yeah, is it a little too long? Maybe. Maybe it could have left one or two of the animal episodes. But overall, I like it. I think I'd probably put it second behind Ill Made Knight.
Here we go. Ill Made Knight. Well, I decide Candle in the Wind, number 2. There, that's official. Queen of Air and Darkness, 3. Sword in the Stone, Book of Merlin. That's my final ranking. And I think it's interesting that once Lancelot comes on the scene, for me, that's where I really start to enjoy it. And I felt like...
You're all about adultery.
I felt like Lancelot's story, he's a character who wants to be noble, that makes bad choices, and all of the action for the rest of the book really deals with either his choices and his actions guide the rest of the plot. Speaking of the adultery, I was left with the feeling when I was in the 4th book that... We know that Lancelot has, in a way, stole Arthur's wife, but I was also struck by the fact that, in a sense, he stole Arthur's narrative, because we're going into Once and Future King thinking this is about King Arthur, but...
Did you say stole?
Like, took.
So stole. There's no D at the end.
You know what I'm saying? Took.
Oh, I know. You said it twice. I was shocked.
Yeah, so you get what I'm saying, though, right? He took the narrative right away from...
No, you
can
say stole is fine, but there's no D at the end of... Stole is not a word.
Well, I address my point more than my words.
Well, I can't.
Is that like when people say across?
Yes, I think it is. Can't stand that either.
So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan.
I think that Lancelot took the narrative right from King Arthur.
Right, he stole it.
He stole it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that's very true. And I think that I think it works thematically. It's a natural outcropping, like I talked about, in terms of what happens in the Arthur mythos. But the fact that White leaves out so much of the other episodes that are traditional in the Arthur cycle, it really emphasizes the thematic value you're noticing.
All right, Seth.
Yeah, I felt like Lancelot was, in a lot of ways, a more compelling character, more interesting character than Arthur, because Arthur kind of ends up taking a backseat to him in most of The Ill-Made Knight, and honestly, in a lot of the rest of the book. And Arthur almost comes off a little weak at times, right? Because he knows there's something going on between Lancelot and Guinevere, but he doesn't want to call the issue. He doesn't want to bring it up and have it come to a head. He just wants to go along. He loves them both. And he's just kind of willing to endure it, which is kind of humiliating for him.
Yeah, it's lame. It makes him kind of lame.
Do you think – so here Arthur does tend to take a backseat in the narrative, just in the cycle as a whole. I think that's because once Arthur is established, he becomes more of an archetype, and he becomes that role. And that's the traditional way of seeing Arthur. Do you think it's a problem, though, in terms of White? Because there is this tension where he's not he clearly admires Arthur, but as I mentioned, I don't think he's entirely successful in proving that Arthur is a proponent of the worldview, the pacifistic worldview that he's trying to put forward. I think there's a little bit of that tension at play with the role that Arthur takes on in those later books, where he does appear weaker. And I think part of it is that White's not entirely sure what to do with him. He's not entirely sure how he sees this character.
Yeah, I can see that. And some of the what you're talking about once they've kind of gotten peace, right? Once he's established the Round Table and established this fellowship of men, and they have peace. They're not skilled at peace, right? They were good at war.
Right.
And that kind of goes back to all the discussions earlier about what is the proper use of force? When is it permissible to use it? Can it be used in the defense of good, or is it always evil? And I don't know. It's an interesting question. But that's where a lot of the mayhem comes from, right? Where they have to go off on quests because there's all these bored knights sitting around that just want to smite something.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also a departure from kind of the traditional Arthurian downfall. So if, you know, in White's view, Arthur's downfall ultimately comes because he isn't able to find a solution to the problem of power and war. I think in the traditional understanding of the mythos, Arthur's downfall comes about by his early sins coming home to roost with Mordred and you know, with the sin that he allows with Guinevere. And it's the slow unraveling of brought about by seeds planted at the beginning of his reign and the beginning of his life. And actually the whole conception of Mordred episode is quite a bit more vicious in the traditional cycle. He kind of goes King Herod on the bit and goes in. At Merlin's behest, kills all the babies who were born on May Day. And so there's certainly – it's an interesting thing when you think about what Arthur represents to the British spirit, that they are willing to work – that at the heart of their archetypal figure is such a serious lapse and serious flaw. And there's no question of the religious allusion to the death of the innocents in the Bible.
Right.
So it's interesting, though, that for Mallory, that's not where the downfall comes from. He doesn't – obviously, Mordred's a character and the same thing happens, and he doesn't paper over it. But he's pretty blunt about the idea that what really happened here was the inability to solve the problem that Merlin had put forward for him.
I think the portrayal of Merlin is interesting, like you were mentioning earlier, Ben. The fact of his kind of living backwards makes it so that he doesn't have this perfect knowledge of the future, you know, where like he doesn't know when would it be applicable for me to warn Arthur about this or that.
Right.
And it kind of changes him from being a really overpowered character who could essentially shape the narrative any way he wanted to one who can, you know, make the occasional misstep.
Right. Especially early on, he's much more bumbling. He's sitting there trying to remember what he's supposed to tell Arthur about, and the fact that he can't remember is part of what brings about the whole Mordred incident and all of that.
I just remembered another place I had seen King Arthur before reading this book. They also had a whole half season of Once Upon a Time that was about King Arthur.
Oh, yeah, that. That's a winner.
Well,
you know,
that's one to hang your hat on.
Yeah, exactly. So in the Mallory version, I believe that Merlin battles somebody named Madame Mim. Is that correct, Ben?
I don't think Madame Mim is in Mallory. I could be wrong.
Well, so I know Madame Mim is in the Disney version of the movie, and I saw online that
we're all connected to the internet. M-A-D. Yeah.
And so I saw online that when they reconstructed Sword in the Stone for Once and Future King, they took out the section where Merlin battles Madame Mim.
Yes.
But that is in the film. So that makes me think, going back to our talk about, does Sword in the Stone stand alone as its own individual book?
You're really concerned.
Yeah, I'm really concerned about this.
I think there's bigger discussion points than whether or not you should put five books or one in Goodreads.
I'm most interested, not about my own book count, but I'm interested in how...
I don't know if that's true.
But I'm interested in how
I don't believe that to be true. How
a book has evolved. Because it came out in one way, and then they make a collection, and they totally change it. I mean, if that happened nowadays...
Yeah, Madame Mim's original to T.H. White. She's not in Mallory.
If that happened nowadays with collected popular series, there'd be an uproar from fans. But at this time, I guess
there's always an uproar from fans.
Exactly.
These are people who are investing their lives in things that don't matter in meaningless ways, and then getting all upset because Robin's wearing blue pants instead of green pants today.
Exactly.
Which remind me to tell you my Batman joke when we get back to the news episode.
Okay, so Sword in the Stone originally comes out in 1938, almost 20 years later. Wait, let me check, make sure this is right. I think it's 1958.
Yeah, 38 is correct.
Okay, when was the collected version of Once and Future King released? That was 58. So 20 years later.
I think it was 58 when it came out.
So 20 years later, you get a messed up version of the story that people grew up with and loved, I'm sure. So that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in how this book has been changed.
He went special edition on it.
So, yes, exactly. So, Seth, then, to go back to Hugo's there, what got the retro Hugo? The original from 38 or the adapted version for the composite Once and Future King?
Oh, I'm pretty sure it was the 38. Let me check real
so
quick.
I haven't,
here.
So, probably us, well, I don't know about you, Seth, but I know for Ben and myself, we've never read the version that won the Hugo Award.
Yeah, we have.
No, we haven't. It's different. It's different.
All the material's there.
It's not. The Madame Mim thing is not there.
So we read the whole thing, plus we read the Madame Mim section.
No, the Madame Mim section was not in the audiobook that we listened to.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Not in the one you listened to, I guess.
It was in the one I listened to.
Thank you.
Okay. Listen to this. Oh, okay. So I guess we'll move on from this.
Yeah, because the point didn't go in your direction, so we got to move on.
I'm reading straight from online. It leaves out some of the episodes that had appeared in the original, notably Merlin's battle with Madame Mim, which appeared in the Disney film.
That was in what I listened to.
To be honest, I don't remember it, but I know you and I listened to the same thing.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I actually wrote it down here that there was stuff in the audiobook that wasn't in the version that I read on my Nook.
Oh, man, this is really crazy.
Right. And the fight with Mim was in there.
So we read everything. But we might have, so there was Madame Mim originally, edited out.
And then edited it back in.
In.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I have two books. It's official.
It's really not. what do you think of, go ahead.
Retro Hugo was awarded for 1939.
Okay.
That would have been the year it would have been eligible for it.
What do you think
that's
about?
The original Sword in the Stone.
What do you think about Retro Hugo Awards, Seth?
Oh, I think it's an interesting idea. It essentially gives the Worldcon the opportunity to go back and reward stuff they think was deserving back in the day.
So do they do one a year, or how does that work?
No, they only do it for years where there was no Worldcon.
Okay.
But then they do it like 50, 75, and 100 years on from there.
How many Retro Hugo Award winners have you covered on your show?
I think just one previous to this one. We did Fahrenheit 451.
Okay. Man, that's interesting. I kind of like that process. Thanks to your podcast, I've been reading a lot more of the Hugo Award winners. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. I have to thank you guys too, just because over the years, you guys have ended up driving quite a few listeners to my podcasts. I get emails and tweets and that kind of stuff from people saying, hey, I found you through the Sci-Fi Christian.
Oh, that's good.
So
that's amazing, considering I never remember what your website's actually called.
Yeah, we always...
I know.
It's Pavement Podcast.
The Pavement Pounding.
That is correct, yeah.
What is it? Is it Pavement Podcast?
Pavement Podcast, yeah, is the Take Me to Your Reader, because originally we were calling it the Pavement Pounders Podcast, but that was too long for a Twitter handle, so...
I like it. Ben?
And then Hugo's podcast for the Hugo one.
Ben, I see you doing some online research. I'm guessing it's to prove me wrong about something. No, what did you find?
I'm just looking at the retro Hugos.
What else do you see there?
Well,
any that we want to cover on our show?
Well, so Farmer in the Sky from Robert Heinlein, which nobody's even read. Robert Heinlein wrote a bunch of books. A couple were good. A lot were crap. Beat Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I don't think that's a retro Hugo, though, is it?
Yeah. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, Wikipedia. It is. You're right. Yeah, 1951.
Beat the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's garbage.
What? Come on.
What garbage?
You like that one.
What? No, I'm saying it's garbage that it beat The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I thought you said it won and that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is garbage.
I'm saying what you would want me to say.
I'm saying what you would want me to say.
Well, no, because you didn't agree with me. That's I want you to agree with me. What did you think of King Pellinore, everyone?
I really enjoyed him, especially in the audiobook, because I liked the guy who voiced him. He sounded very silly and foppish.
Yeah, I love King Pellinore.
I could have lived without him.
He was kind of an obvious.
I could have lived without you.
But
sorry,
Was that
that got a little vicious?
I said I could have lived without him. And what were you saying, Seth?
Oh, I mean, he was kind of obviously a comedic character for a lot of it, right? Because he seemed silly.
Right.
And at first, I wondered, does this questing beast actually exist? And it wasn't until later on, after he had kind of gone to live with whatever the other sir name was, I can't remember, that we found out that the questing beast was real and needed to be pursued, right?
No, he means the other knight.
Oh.
Yeah, the questing beast is great, and all of the questing beast gets very sad when King Pellinore isn't there, and it's brilliant. I loved it. I'm sorry that you didn't.
I mean, it was fine. It didn't make me hate it or anything.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, so I think even though the Hugo went to Sword in the Stone, not the best part of Once and Future King. So for your listeners, Seth, I'd say just stick it out, get through Sword in the Stone, and it gets way better in books 2, 3, 4, and then be prepared to be disappointed for a overly long wrap-up that has no purpose.
It's a short wrap-up, but it is overly long.
Is.
And both those statements are true.
I remember in the Book of Merlin, there at some point there was a whole chapter that just seemed like it was a long list.
Yeah, it's painful. I just kept looking at the audiobook. Is this thing over yet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad at like 1.8 speed.
Oh, yeah. See, I can't do that.
Yeah, Ben has some strict rules about speeding up books.
I do.
Because they're an art form.
Oh, man.
And you can't make a person's voice go faster because that would be against the art.
That's right. That's right. That's
no, not I completely what God disagree. Wants.
Even
being on the podcast with you guys, talking with you guys in normal speed, I usually listen to you at 1.5 speed. So you sound really slow.
It bothers me that people do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I try and maintain a particular cadence.
Oh, your cadence is still there. It's just a little quicker.
No, that's the opposite of the cadence being still there. It completely deteriorates.
It's a quicker cadence.
No, exactly. It's no longer my cadence. And so I feel like our timing and our cadences are an important part of what we do to be, well, let's face it, the greatest podcast on the internet. And it bothers me that people like yourself, Seth, are just ruining that by speeding us up or slowing us down or whatever everybody's doing.
Yep. You are at the mercy of my whims.
Yeah.
Happy to help.
So here's something interesting. So listeners that have heard me on the podcast before will know that I don't like spoilers. However, because Sword in the Stone was sort of a slog for me, it helped me to read some online spoilers about what was coming up in the story. Because I wasn't familiar with Arthur's mythology, to kind of watch for things that were happening and the little clues that White was dropping. So I can appreciate what White was doing artistically. I just didn't love how it started. But when I read a little bit about the Queen of Air and Darkness online before I actually got to it, I started to know, actually, I was just starting it, and I was like, who are these four new people? I don't know what's going on. But so, in the end, the point of the story is spoilers actually helped me here.
Well, that's great.
So you looked up, and there was a spoiler that there was a sword in a stone?
Yeah, it was inside the stone. And get this.
Didn't you get that from the title?
No, I'm talking about, I was trying to figure out why my book said The Witch in the Wood, and while the other book said The Queen of Air and Darkness, so I was trying to figure out what the difference was. And as I was looking that up, I ended up finding out what the second book was about. So then, as I'm listening to the second book, I started to be able to put the pieces together more easily because of those spoilers. Sword in the Stone was a little bit self-explanatory.
Right.
Plus, that's like the only part of Arthur.
The Queen of Air and Darkness starts with that kind of extended argument between all of Morgause's sons, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a strange place to start for me. I thought, what did I miss here about the setup for that?
Right. And for like you and me, Seth, we didn't know the Arthur mythology. So just being introduced to these four characters who are very important at the time, I was kind of like, well, I don't know why I should care about these four. Little did I know. Well,
that should teach you not to think those types of thoughts when you're reading a great book.
Right. You're right.
Right.
Just keep going. Just keep pushing through.
It's about submission.
So what's your final rating here for it? Sword in the Stone and Once a Future King as a whole?
I mean, despite the fact that I had some trouble with the Sword in the Stone, found it a bit of a slog in places, I still really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed it especially on audio. In print, I don't know. I wasn't a huge fan, but I liked the performance of the audiobook narrator. So I think I give it 3 stars on Goodreads, because I don't do half stars. I probably would have gone 3.5. And then the Once and Future King, you know, kind of like we've discussed, the Ill-Made Knight and the Candle in the Wind were ones that I really enjoyed in there. And so, yeah, I think I enjoyed that overall more than I enjoyed The Sword in the Stone.
Totally agree. 5 stars all around, but Sword in the Stone would be at the bottom of my list. Ben?
5 stars, except for the Book of Merlin, which was garbage.
And there it is.
See, no, I don't feel compelled to give classic books 5 stars. I'm very much like, that one didn't work for me. Sorry. So
I do.
I'm just reading it kind of on the Matt Anderson thing, right? Did I enjoy this?
Yeah, that is how I usually do. But I do give a nod towards classic movies and well, books.
That's an interesting question, though. Do we consider this a classic by the standard I'm talking about with that policy?
Hmm.
So is this a classic in the same way that Don Quixote is a classic or Great Expectations is a classic? I don't know. I think it's probably close, but I'm not convinced it's there quite yet.
I'd say yes. Seth?
Yeah, I think it's kind of close, but I'm not totally sure. I always thought of this as being an earlier book than it actually is.
Yeah, me too.
Right.
But you know, we consider Lord of the Rings classic, right?
And that's I think I'd put Lord of the Rings in a similar boat. I think it will be a classic, but I don't think it quite has the longevity.
How many years have to go by to be considered classic?
I don't think it's more about years. I think it's part of what makes a classic is it's speaking to multiple generations of people over multiple time, a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just because a book is old doesn't make it a classic.
Correct. So I think that...
Like Farmer in the Sky, whereas I would say The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is a classic.
Right. Or at least getting there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that stuff like that, it's tough to say that anything post-1950 is really classic in that sense. I mean, I think there's some books that have probably reached that consensus already, but, you know, and fantasy has a deck stacked against it because it hasn't been treated with serious scholarship, even though there are clearly works. You know, this one, Lord of the Rings, Dune, I think that deserve that type of more serious literary engagement, but they haven't gotten it. And mm-hmm. so that slows it down, because I think that part of what makes classic, it's not that there's a series of gatekeepers out there, but you want to see, can it be engaged with on that more serious literary level? I think those ones can, but I think it's going to take time before they fully get there.
Yeah.
All right, Seth, I think I'm ready to wrap up, unless you have some closing things for the Who Goes There podcast.
No, I don't think I do. I want to thank you guys for doing this. You know, this was one that I wanted to get to eventually, and so I was glad to hear when you were talking about reading it. And thank you so much for being willing to do it.
Hey, since we're on each other's podcast, you plug all the websites you have. I'll let Ben plug his website, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, you can find the Who Goes There podcast at whogoespodcast.com, and there's episodes from both Matt and Ben. Ben's book was better.
Yeah, because you guys did Red Shirts. That book is garbage.
But it
was enjoyable.
I liked it.
I'd like to hear Ben's full thoughts on it at another time. But then you can also find my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, at pavementpodcast.com, because our branding doesn't make sense.
And Take Me to Your Reader, tell them a little bit about what your format is for that.
Sure. That's we look at a movie that is based on something written, usually, you know, so short story, novella, or novel. Sometimes we look at TV as well that's adapted. and then kind of compare and contrast. It's really fun when there's like a movie and a remake movie, like with The Thing. It's not always cool because Total Recall had a remake too. But yeah.
How many episodes have been on for Take Me to Your Reader? I can remember The Martian, but is that it? Was I only on one time?
Yeah, yeah, it's just The Martian. And then Ben was on for 2001. And again,
nice.
Ben's movie was better.
Yeah. Wow.
But
it's striking out.
It's one that I've recently come around on, where The Martian I immediately enjoyed, whereas 2001, the first time I watched it, I kind of went, okay, I watched that movie.
Yeah.
And that was it.
That's how I felt. But then I keep on watching with Ben and it keeps getting better.
Right.
All right, Ben, tell us where we can find you and The Sci-Fi Christian.
At thescifichristian.com.
All right. And how many podcast episodes have we been on together?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. All right, everybody. I think that's it. Seth, thank you very much. Thanks for letting us be on your show. And thanks for joining us on our show. I love this crossover connection. This is great. Ben, thanks for being here as usual.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, that's all from here. Here's the music.
Thanks for enduring having a guest on, both of you, because I know as a unit you don't like guests.
No, I love it.
I would say any time, but I don't mean any time, but you can come back again sometime.
Okay.
Well, everybody, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I'm Ben DiBono.
Seth, you can say hi.
And I'm Seth Easley.
And we are the Sci-Fi Christians signing off.
Sorry, I lost you guys for a minute.
I think it's because the music is playing, so you might not be able to hear it through Skype.
Goodbye.
Cool. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. A little unorthodox for what I typically do in the podcast here, but I did want to check that box that The Sword and the Stone had been covered, and now I consider that it has. So, like I said at the beginning, I will be back in June with a new episode. In the meantime, if you'd like to reach out on social media, you can do that at Hugo's Podcast, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. You can send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or you can fill out the contact form on hugospodcast.com. And I'd love to hear from you. And I think that's enough housekeeping for this episode. So I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.